I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is cognitive psychologist and science writer Steven Pinker. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Steven Pinker.
Our guest this evening is Steven Pinker. He is an experimental psychologist and the Johnstone Family Professor in the Harvard Department of Psychology. His research covers everything from visual cognition and psycholinguistics to social relations. His award-winning books include The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, The Blank Slate, The Better Angels of Our Nature, and The Sense of Style. His latest book, Enlightenment Now, makes the case that on the whole, the world is improving, and it can be further improved if we embrace the right principles. What principles does he mean? Let's find out. Please welcome Steven Pinker back to the JCCSF.
Thank you very much. Good evening. From time to time, we all ask deep and difficult questions. Why is the world filled with so much trouble? How can we make it better? How do we give meaning and purpose to our lives? Well, as difficult as these questions may seem, many people have answers to them. Morality is dictated by God in Holy Scriptures. When everyone obeys his laws, the world will be perfect. Demons, problems are the fault of evil people who must be shamed, punished, and defeated. Nationalism, our tribe must claim its rightful greatness under the control of a strong leader who embodies its authentic virtue. Reaction, in the past, we lived in a state of order and harmony. Until alien forces brought on decadence and degeneration, we must restore the society to its golden age. Well, what about the rest of us? Many people know what they don't believe, but it's harder to put our finger on what we do believe. In Enlightenment Now, I suggest there is an alternative system of beliefs and values, the one that we associate with the 18th century Enlightenment, namely that we can use knowledge to enhance human flourishing. Now, many people embrace the ideals of the Enlightenment without being able to name or describe them. As a result, they faded into the background as a bland default or status quo or establishment. The other ideologies have passionate advocates, and I suggest that Enlightenment ideals, too, need a positive defense and an explicit commitment. What do I mean by those ideals? I think the Enlightenment revolves around four themes: reason, science, humanism, and progress. Let me say a few words about each. It all begins with reason, with the understanding that traditional sources of belief are generators of delusion. Faith, revelation, tradition, authority, charisma, mysticism, intuition, the hermeneutic parsing of sacred texts are all ways of being wrong. Reason, in contrast, is non-negotiable. As soon as you try to provide reasons why we should trust anything other than reason, that is, as soon as you explain why you're right, why other people should believe you, as soon as you insist that you're not lying or full of crap, you've lost the argument because you have appealed to reason. Now, as a cognitive psychologist, I would be the first to acknowledge that human beings on their own are not particularly reasonable. As a species, we are liable to generalize from anecdotes. We reason from stereotypes. We seek evidence that confirms our beliefs, and we blow off evidence that disconfirms them. And we're all overconfident about our knowledge, our wisdom, and our goodness. But people are capable of reason if they adopt certain norms. Among them, free speech, open criticism and debate, logical analysis, fact-checking, and empirical testing, which leads to the second Enlightenment ideal, science. Science is based on the conviction that the world is intelligible, that we can seek to understand it by formulating possible explanations and testing them against reality. Science has shown itself to be our most reliable means of understanding the world, including ourselves. An important Enlightenment theme was that there can be a science of human nature, and that beliefs about society are testable, just like any other beliefs about the world. Science, moreover, provides not just technical know-how, but also fundamental insights about the human condition, such as naturalism. The universe has no goal or purpose related to human welfare, which means that if we want to improve that welfare, we have to figure out how to do it ourselves. Entropy in a closed system, disorder increases. Things fall apart, stuff happens. Not because the universe has it in for us, but simply because there are vastly more ways for things to go wrong than to go right. Evolution. Humans were shaped by a process which selects for reproductive success, not well-being. As Immanuel Kant put it at the height of the Enlightenment, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no truly straight thing can be built. The third theme is humanism, that the ultimate moral purpose is to reduce the suffering and enhance the flourishing of human beings and other sentient creatures. Well, enhancing human flourishing, you might think, who could possibly be opposed to that? Well, there are alternatives to humanism, such as that the ultimate goal is to enhance the glory of the tribe, the nation, the race, the class, or the faith, to obey the dictates of a divinity and pressure others to do the same, to achieve feats of heroic greatness, or to advance some mystical dialectic or struggle or pursuit of a utopian or messianic age. Humanism is feasible because people are endowed with a sense of sympathy, a concern with the welfare of others. Now, by default, our circle of sympathy is rather small, and humans tend to sympathize only with their blood relatives, their close friends and allies, cute little furry baby animals, and that's about it. But our circle of sympathy can be expanded through the dynamics of cosmopolitanism, the mixing of people and ideas, such as education, journalism, art, mobility, and even pure reason. As soon as you engage with discourse with someone else, I can't insist that only my interests count because I'm me and you're not, and hope for you to take me seriously. There's an inherent symmetry built into the very process of reasoning. Finally, that leads us to the ideal of progress, that if we apply knowledge and sympathy to reduce suffering and enhance flourishing, we can gradually succeed. You may ask, if human nature doesn't change, how could progress be possible? And an answer from the Enlightenment is that it's possible through benign institutions that allow us to deploy energy and knowledge to combat entropy, that magnify the better angels of our nature, as Abraham Lincoln put it, such as reason and sympathy, while inhibiting our inner demons, our biases, our illusions, our tribalism, our thirst for dominance and vengeance. What do I mean by Enlightenment institutions? Well, some of them that we enjoy today that are legacies of that era include democracy, declarations of rights, markets, organizations for global cooperation, and institutions of truth-seeking, such as academies, scientific societies, a free press, and community centers. So, 250 years later, how did that Enlightenment thing work out? Well, I have found that if you ask most intellectuals, the answer is not very well, because I have found that intellectuals hate progress. And intellectuals who call themselves progressive really hate progress. If you think we can solve problems, I have been told, that means you have a blind faith and a quasi-religious belief in the outmoded superstition of the false promise of the myth of the onward march of inevitable progress. You are a cheerleader for vulgar American can-do-ism. With the rah-rah spirit of boardroom ideology, Silicon Valley, and the Chamber of Commerce. You are a practitioner of Whig history, a naive optimist, a Pollyanna, and of course a pangloss, alluding to the Voltaire character who declared all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Well, as it happens, Professor Pangloss was a pessimist. A true optimist would believe there could be much better worlds than the one that we find ourselves in today. But all of this is irrelevant because the question of whether progress has occurred is not a matter of optimism or pessimism or seeing the glass as half full or half empty. It is an empirical hypothesis. Human well-being can be measured. Life, health, sustenance, prosperity, peace, freedom, safety, knowledge, leisure, happiness. If they have increased over time, I submit, that would be progress. Well, let's go to the data. Beginning with the most precious thing of all, life. For most of human history, life expectancy at birth hovered around 30 years of age. But then, in the 18th century, with discoveries of vaccination, later sanitation, antibiotics, and other advances in public health and medicine, life expectancy at birth increased to, today, 71 years, and virtually no one guesses that it's that high. The escape from universal early death was highly uneven. It was Europe and the Americas that first saw lifespans increase, but more recently Asia has almost caught up and sub-Saharan Africa is showing spectacular gains. For most of human history, the biggest cause of low life expectancy at birth was child mortality because children are so fragile. In Sweden, 270 years ago, one-third of children did not live to see their fifth birthday. Sweden brought its rate of child mortality down by a factor of about 100, and other parts of the world followed suit, such as in North America, Canada, in Asia, South Korea, in South America, Chile, and in Africa, Ethiopia, which is now has a child mortality rate of 6%, still far too high, but it is coming down. Mothers, too, were in mortal peril when they gave birth. In the 18th century, 1% of Swedish mothers died in childbirth. That was reduced by a factor of 250. Similar reductions took place in the United States, in Malaysia, and once again in Ethiopia. Health. For most of human history, one of the biggest killers was infectious disease. That has all been eliminated in rich countries. Infectious disease still kills in huge numbers in poor countries, but in the last 20 years, the mortality rates from the five most lethal infectious diseases in poor countries have all been in decline: pneumonia, diarrhea, malaria, measles, and HIV/AIDS. Sustenance. It takes about 2,500 calories to feed an active young man, and for most of human history, societies were unable to grow that many calories. Until the agricultural revolution in England in the 18th century saw advances in agronomy, such as crop rotation, later the invention of synthetic fertilizers, the mechanization of agriculture, the selective breeding of vigorous hybrids with the Green Revolution, and transportation networks that could bring food from farm to table, and other countries such as the United States, France, and more recently China and India have been growing enough food to feed themselves. Now, this would be a dubious form of progress if all those calories were just going to making fat people fatter. But in fact, they have decimated the rate of undernourishment across the world. In 1970, about one-third of people in the developing world were undernourished. That has come down by more than half, first in Latin America, then in Asia, and there are steep reductions in sub-Saharan Africa. As a result of this ability to grow food, famine, one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, has been in decline. Famines today take place not because of insufficient food, but because in remote or war-torn regions, it's hard to get the food to people who need it. Prosperity. For most of human history, the natural state of humanity was poverty. If you define extreme poverty as the equivalent of $1.90 per person per day in today's dollars, by that criterion, 90% of the world's population was poor, until it shot up exponentially with the Industrial Revolution, with advances in technology, with the education of the population, with instruments of finance and global trade, more recently globalization. There's been a 200-fold increase in prosperity since the 18th century. As a result, the rate of extreme poverty has declined. Progress was highly uneven across the world's surface. It was the United States and the UK that first made the great escape, as Angus Deaton has called it, from universal squalor and deprivation. But more recently, Asian countries like South Korea, South American countries like Chile, and China and India have been showing exponential growth as well. As a result, the rate of extreme poverty has fallen from 90% 200 years ago to less than 10%. And in fact, this year, a study announced that for the first time in history, a majority of the world's population can be classified as middle class. We can see this change in in the shift of the world's income distribution. In 1800, basically the entire world population was poor. By 1975, the distribution has two humps. You could speak about poor countries and rich countries. But today, the distribution has one hump, and there you see the fantastic growth in global prosperity. And the fact that while countries vary, there is no longer a division of the world into rich countries and poor countries. Although inequality as a result, between countries has decreased, of course, inequality within rich countries has increased. But that doesn't mean that rich countries have become more indifferent to the plight of the needy. Quite the contrary. At the end of the 19th century, and for centuries before, rich countries devoted no more than 1.5% of their GDP to social transfers, that is, to children, to the elderly, to the poor, to the sick. But in the 20th century, every developed country went on a binge of social spending, so that today the median OECD country redistributes 22% of its GDP to the needy. Because of this redistribution, the poverty rate, when it's measured in terms of disposable income, that is, after taxes and transfers, has fallen from about a third of Americans in 1960 to 7% today. And when poverty is measured in terms of consumption, that is, what people can afford to buy in terms of food, clothing, and shelter, the poverty rate has declined from 30% to 3%. Peace. For most of the history of nations, the natural state of relations between empires and states was war, and peace was merely a brief interlude between wars. But 300 or 400 years ago, the great powers were pretty much always at war. Now, they are never at war. The last great power war pitted the United States against China in the Korean War more than 60 years ago. Now, if we zoom in on the 20th century, we see that even as wars were becoming shorter and less frequent, two of the ones that did occur did horrific amounts of damage, namely World War I and World War II. But contrary to predictions that I grew up with, namely that World War III was just a matter of time, that it would pit the United States against the Soviet Union in a nuclear exchange that would be even more damaging than World War II, the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union went out of existence, and World War III never happened. So if you look at the period of history that we've been living in for the last 73 years, since the end of World War II, you see that there's been a bumpy but unmistakable decline in the rate of deaths from all wars, from about 20 per 100,000 per year to less than 1 per 100,000 per year. This is a gift of the spread of democracy, because democracies are less likely to fight each other, of commerce, because when countries are engaged in trade, it becomes cheaper to buy things than to plunder them. And when you are trading with someone, you don't kill your customers, you don't kill your debtors. It's come from peacekeeping forces that insert themselves between belligerents and prevent flare-ups. And it comes from international laws and norms against conquest. War used to be a perfectly legitimate way of settling disputes. It was the continuation of policy by other means. Today, war is illegal, and even though wars take place, they are considered measures of last resort rather than the normal course of events as they were through most of human history.
You're listening to cognitive psychologist and science writer Steven Pinker, whose new book is Enlightenment Now: The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Freedom and rights. We all have been concerned with the recession of democracy in countries like Turkey and Venezuela and Russia and Hungary. Nonetheless, if you add up all of the country's democracy scores and their autocracy scores, so you don't look at the worst cases, but you look at the entire globe, you see that the world has never been more democratic. And lest that seem impossible to believe, recall that is in the turn of the 19th century, the world had a handful of democracies embracing about 1% of the world's population. Today, it's about two-thirds of the world's countries embracing two-thirds of the world's population. Now, lest that seem absolutely incredible, we could recall for those of you who were around in the 1970s or have read up on what the world was like in the 1970s, half of Europe was behind the Iron Curtain and dominated by communist totalitarian dictatorships. Spain and Portugal were literally fascist dictatorships. Greece was run by a military junta, as was virtually all of South America and all of East Asia, including Taiwan, South Korea, Philippines, Indonesia, all of them democratic today. Even in the past year, there were advances in democracy in Armenia, Ethiopia, Kenya, Malaysia, and Sri Lanka. Child labor. For most of human history, children were routinely sent to work in farms and factories, about 30% of British children in 1850. But with the increase in prosperity of developed countries, the premium that accrues to education, so that children became more valuable sent to school than laboring in the fields, and with a general increase in the valuation of the lives of children, The rate of child labor was brought down in England, the United States, other countries like Italy, and increasingly in the world as a whole. In 2015, the Nobel Peace Prize was shared by Kailash Satyarthi for his efforts at reducing child labor. Such efforts have had a real effect. Violent crime. In any part of the world that exists beyond the reach of the law, that is, in any part of the world that lives in anarchy, you tend to get predation and revenge and cycles of vendetta and blood feuds. For example, in medieval Europe, in the patchwork of feudal baronies and fiefs, the homicide rate was about 35 per 100,000 per year. As medieval kingdoms established their control over this anarchic patchwork, the rate of homicide dropped in every European country from about 35 to about 1. That is a reduction by a factor of 35. That happens in every part of the world in which frontier regions are brought under the control of the rule of law and police and courts replace the self-defense and posses and vigilante justice, such as in colonial New England, in the American Wild West, And even in countries that remain violent today, such as Mexico, they were even more violent a century ago. We zoom in on the last 60 years or so, we see that in the United States there has been a reduction in homicide of about more than 50%, and the world as a whole has seen a reduction of about 30%. It isn't just homicide that has been in decline, but violence against women, such as domestic violence against wives and girlfriends and rape and sexual assault. The rate of rape in the United States has fallen by 75% since the 1970s. And the victimization of children, both violent victimization at school and physical and sexual abuse by caregivers. In fact, we have been getting safer in just about every way. Because of advances in the design of automobiles and of highways, your chance of getting killed in a car accident has fallen by 96% over the last century. We are 88% less likely to be mowed down on the sidewalk, 99% less likely to die in a plane crash. There were no commercial plane crashes in the year 2018. We are less likely to fall to our deaths, to drown, to die by fire, to die by poison gas or vapor. There is one exception to this trend in increasing safety, and that's the category that safety statisticians call poison by solid or liquid. The category includes drug overdoses, and there you are seeing the American opioid epidemic. At the same time, we're 95% less likely to be killed on the job. We're even less likely to be killed in acts of God, in the droughts, wildfires, floods, storms, landslides, heat waves, meteor strikes, and earthquakes. Presumably not because God is any less angry with us, but because of stronger infrastructure, better early warning systems, and more resilient emergency response systems. We are even less likely to die from the ultimate act of God, the projectile hurled by Zeus, the literal bolt from the blue. Yes, we are 97% less likely to be killed by a bolt of lightning. Knowledge. The natural state of humanity is ignorance and illiteracy. In early modern Europe, only about 15% of the population, the most privileged, could read or write. By the 20th century, that had risen to 100% in every European country. And the United States, and more recently the rest of the world has been catching up. Today, 80% of the world is literate and 90% of the world population under the age of 25. Not just men, but also women. In 1750, the literacy rate for women in England was 58% that of men, but England achieved gender parity in the turn of the 20th century. And the rest of the world is very, very close. Even the most backward parts of the world, countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan, have seen increases in the rate of female literacy. Thanks for that. Go to the other winner of the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize, Malala Yousafzai. And in what is perhaps the most incredible, astonishing, difficult to credit example of progress that I have seen, we have been getting smarter. This is true. In a well-documented phenomenon known as the Flynn effect, IQ scores have increased all over the world by 3 points a decade, a gift of the spread of education, of the increased use of visual symbols in everyday life, and by the trickling down of abstract technical concepts from science and technology and education into everyday life. Okay, well, has any of this made our lives any better? I've given you a number of variables that economists like to measure, but what do they do to our day-to-day lives? Well, they have increased our quality of life. For example, the number of hours that we spend at work, which was 150 years ago, was more than 60 hours a week. In Western Europe and the United States, that has fallen to fewer than 40 hours, and typical workers now have 3 weeks of paid vacation, a concept that would have been inconceivable in the 19th century. Thanks to the universal penetration of running water and electricity, and to the widespread adoption of labor-saving devices like washing machines, vacuum cleaners, refrigerators, dishwashers, stoves, and microwaves, the amount of our lives that we forfeit to housework, which people indicate in surveys is the least favorite way of spending their time, has decreased from 60 hours a week to fewer than 15 hours a week. Thanks to the shorter work week and the amount of our lives that we claw back from housework, the amount of leisure time that Americans have has increased over the last 50 years or so, both for men and for women. Now, you can't help but notice that increase kind of leveled off in the 1990s. And the reason is that women today spend more time with their children. A single working woman today spends more hours with her children than a married stay-at-home mom did in the 1950s. So forget Ozzie and Harriet, forget Leave It to Beaver. We also spend less of our paycheck on necessities, food, clothing, and shelter, from 60% a century ago to a third today. Okay, well, does any of this make us any happier? And the answer is, by and large, it does. If you look at countries that have whose citizens have been polled as to whether they are happy, in 49 out of 69 countries for which we have data going back to 1981, happiness has increased. Interestingly, the United States is not one of them, although the United States was pretty happy to start with. Has all this progress come at the expense of the environment? And the answer is, it surely has. However, as countries get richer, they can afford to cleaner forms of energy, and their values ascend a hierarchy of needs, and so people are willing to spend more to protect the environment. As a result, in 178 out of 180 countries whose environmental quality has been measured over the last 10 years, the environmental quality has improved. One of the greatest pressures on the environment, namely the human population, the growth rate in human population peaked in the 1960s and it has plummeted, with the result that, according to the best projection, human population will probably peak in around 2070 at about 9 billion. Because of environmental regulations in wealthy countries like the United States, the environment has shown unmistakable improvement. Since 1970, when the EPA was formed, the American population has increased by 40%. Our GDP has increased by a factor of 2.5. We have driven twice as many miles, but the rate of emissions of the five major air pollutants has declined by 60%. In one more form of progress that environmental progress that I'll mention, the amount of the Earth's surface that is protected against economic exploitation and the amount of the world's oceans that are protected against commercial exploitation has doubled just in the last 20 years. Okay, well, I hope to have persuaded you that progress is not just a matter of disposition, of seeing the world through rose-colored glasses. It is an empirical fact about the state of life on Earth. Well, how is this fact reflected in the news? This comes back to life, I will show you one more graph, which shows the result of an algorithmic analysis of the tone of the news. That is the ratio of positive words to negative words in a large sample of news stories. And what it shows is that during all these decades in which our lives have been getting longer and healthier and richer and safer and more peaceful, the stories in the New York Times have gotten increasingly morose. And it isn't just the New York Times, but a sample of the world's broadcasts shows the same. So why do people deny progress? Again, this is not a question of temperament. It's a question of being aware of facts. Part of it comes from the nature of cognition. Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman have shown that people tend to estimate risk and probability according to how easily they can recall examples from memory. We use our brain's search engine as a way of estimating probability. Now, combine that with the nature of news. News is about stuff that happens. It's not about stuff that doesn't happen. You never see a journalist saying, "I'm reporting live from a country that's at peace." Or from a city that has not been attacked by terrorists. Also, news is about sudden events, not gradual changes. As Max Roser has pointed out, the papers could have run the headline, 137,000 people escaped from extreme poverty yesterday, every day for the last 30 years. But they never ran that headline, with the result that 1.25 billion people escaped from extreme poverty, and no one knows about it. News also has a bias toward the negative. Many journalists believe that good news is corporate public relations or government propaganda or human interest fluff, and it's imperative to prevent people from falling into a state of complacency. Captured in a satirical headline from the newspaper The Onion, CNN holds morning meeting to decide what viewers should panic about for rest of day. So if you combine the nature of human cognition with the nature of journalism, you can understand why the world is coming to an end and always has been. There's also a negativity bias in human psychology, that bad is stronger than good. We think about and feel bad events more than good events, especially recent bad events. With the passage of time, we still remember things, but we forget how bad they were, leading to the observation by Franklin Pierce Adams that nothing is more responsible for the good old days than a bad memory. There's also a market for would-be prophets. Pessimists sound like they're trying to help you. Optimists sound like they're trying to sell you something. As Tom Lehrer once noted, always predict the worst and you'll be hailed as a prophet. Let me wrap up with three questions about progress and enlightenment that I'm sure have occurred to many of you. You might think, isn't it good to be pessimistic, to speak truth to power, to rake the muck? Well, not exactly. It's good to be accurate. Of course, we have to be aware of suffering and injustice wherever they occur, but we also have to be aware of how they can be reduced. Because there are dangers to thoughtless pessimism, just as there are dangers to complacency. One of them is fatalism. If you think that all of the efforts that people have made to improve human well-being have been a miserable failure, the rational response is, well, why waste time and money on a hopeless cause? As Jesus said, the poor will always be with you. Let's just enjoy ourselves while we can. Another danger is radicalism. If you believe that all of our institutions are in terminal decline and are beyond all hopes of reform, the natural response is to smash the machine, to drain the swamp, to burn the empire to the ground, or to empower a leader who promises, "Only I can fix it." A second question, is progress inevitable? Does progress mean that everything becomes better for everyone, everywhere, all the time? The answer is, that would not be progress. That would be a miracle. Progress is not a miracle. Progress consists of using knowledge to solve problems. Problems are inevitable, and solutions create new problems that must be resolved in their turn. Also, even as progress occurs incrementally, there can always be nasty surprises, and I've shown you a number of them just in my slides tonight: the two world wars, the 1960s crime boom, AIDS in Africa, and the opioid epidemic. And the world faces severe global challenges, which it has not yet solved. Foremost among them are the threat of climate change and the threat of nuclear war. I argue in Enlightenment Now that these are unsolved problems, but that doesn't mean that we should treat them as unsolvable problems, that we must avert global warming by aggressively pursuing decarbonization of the world's economy, by a combination of policy, such as carbon pricing, and technology, namely the development of low, zero, and eventually negative carbon technologies. We should deal with the threat of nuclear war by denuclearizing the world's armies, by a regime of international stability that prevents accidents and misunderstandings, and by a program of arms reduction, culminating ultimately in global zero, the formerly utopian goal of eliminating all nuclear weapons that recently has been embraced even by Cold War hawks such as George Shultz and Henry Kissinger.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is cognitive psychologist and science writer Steven Pinker, whose new book is Enlightenment Now: The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Just a little indication that progress is not impossible. If you look at how much CO2 has to be emitted to yield a dollar of wealth, then you see that countries tend to follow historically an arc that as they first develop, they burn lots of coal to get lots of energy in a hurry. They then switch to lower carbon forms of fuel, such as oil and then natural gas and then solar, hydro, wind, and nuclear. This is a process that has taken place in the UK and the US. More recently, China has turned a sharp corner and is emitting less CO2 per dollar of GDP, as is India and the world as a whole. Now, again, this is not enough to deal with the problem of climate change. Those curves have to go down to zero, and under current policy, they won't. But roadmaps have been laid out as to how they could. Likewise, when it comes to nuclear weapons, few people realize that the world's nuclear arsenal has been reduced by 85% since the peak of the Cold War. With many of these developments, I have to add, they are absolutely under threat by the current administration. Just about every policy that I have mentioned so far has been opposed, and there are threats even to roll back the drivers of the progress that I have identified. My final question, does the Enlightenment just go against human nature? Is humanism just too arid or tepid or flattened to get people's hearts pumping? Is the conquest of disease, famine, poverty, violence, and ignorance boring? Do people need to believe in miracles, a father in the sky, a strong chief to protect the tribe, myths of heroic ancestors? Well, I don't think so. For one thing, we know that secular liberal democracies are the happiest and healthiest places on Earth, probably in the history of our species, and they are the prime destination of people who vote with their feet. And would argue that applying knowledge and sympathy to enhance human flourishing is heroic, glorious, maybe even spiritual. It is not just a myth. Myths are fictions, and this one is true, true to the best of our knowledge, which is the only truth we can have. And it's a hero story that belongs not just to one tribe, but to all of humanity, to every sentient creature with the power of reason and the urge to persist in its being. Because it depends on nothing more than the convictions that life is better than death, health is better than sickness, abundance is better than want, freedom is better than coercion, peace is better than war, happiness is better than suffering, and knowledge is better than superstition and ignorance. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We have time for some questions.
You are one person who's written a book for which we thank you, but it doesn't seem, sadly, like it's enough to counter the huge wave of negative bias that the media pours over us all the time. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas as to how that might change, and does it even have to change since we've been progressing despite this?
Yes, well, it's some of the progress occurred before that huge decline in emotional tone that has occurred, starting in the 40s and with another dip after the 70s. I think it ought to change. We've seen in the past presidential election, we had a candidate who rode to power on a highly dystopian platform, including some a number of outright howlers, such as that crime was increasing in a period of 2 decades in which it had fallen by more than half. Continuing is that there wasn't much resistance from the left who bought into a dystopia of increasing inequality and terrorism and dysfunctional institutions. The goal would not be to have competitive spin doctoring, but rather just a more fact-based understanding of the country so that we would allocate our efforts and resources to where the problems really are. The opioid crisis really is a crisis. Terrorism really is not a crisis, to say nothing of terrorism from Central American immigrants. But even terrorism on the whole kills a fraction of the number of people that are killed by much more preventable hazards, such as drug overdoses, such as drunk driving, such as obesity, and so on. So there actually are a number of movements originating from some quarters of journalism that are coming to realize that a bias toward the negative is not serving anyone's interests. Of course, crises have to be reported, clearly. But if they're the only thing that's reported, then that's a kind of distortion that can have the corrosive consequences that I mentioned. There's a solutions journalism network founded by David Bornstein and Tina Rosenberg of originally of the New York Times. There's a constructive journalism institute in Europe. There's a new paper or a publication called The Correspondent that seeks to present a more balanced view. But there are several movements, and what I would like to see is it sounds so obvious once you mention it, but there's certain things that the newspapers cover very objectively, where they will give you the data every day, like the stock market, like sports, like the weather, like commodities prices. Why can't we have regular reports of things like the homicide rate, the CO2 emissions, war deaths, so kind of a dashboard for the world, so that rather than the current practice, which is to only report the downticks of an upward trend or the upticks of a downward trend, because they are, quote, news, with the result that people get a systematically incorrect understanding of reality, because the only time that something like highway deaths are reported is when they go up. Now, they've been going, down, down, down. Nothing only goes down. There are some years in which they're reversed. Those are the years in which they're covered with the news. So the only time you read about the highway death rate is when it gets worse. A newsreader can walk away thinking it gets worse and worse and worse, even as it gets better and better and better. Whereas more systematic reporting of data would circumvent that problem. It would also let us know what the effects are of our technological policies, such as, I think it should have been known, say, that when Germany closed down its nuclear power plants, its CO2 emissions skyrocketed. Now, you would know that if CO2 emissions were reported on a regular basis. You could just see suddenly the curve shoot up, and so on. We would just, likewise for crime, likewise for anything that we care about, include longevity, education, achievement, and so on.
About perception of reality being not what reality is there a significant concern with mental health in maybe the younger generation changing to some degree to where people have their own perception of, their social networks, and that leading to actual alienation from the rest of the society?
Yeah, there is. So I've looked into those claims. The Enlightenment Now came out, or went to press after that panicky cover story in the Atlantic a year ago last summer that claimed that the iGen, the generation of people born after 1995, were on the brink of an unprecedented mental health crisis because of their addiction to smartphones and their fear of missing out. Turned out that this was by a respected psychologist, Gene Twenge, but almost everyone who's looked at the data have concluded that this is a panicky story that is way out of proportion to anything that's really happened. Of course, every generation gnaws their knuckles about the kids today, and certainly that was true when I was a teenager, and the baby boomers were thought to be the ones that were bringing civilization down the drain. Then it was the millennials who were narcissistic, and now it's the iGens who are addicted to their smartphones. So it's not true. Among other things, the younger, the Generation Z, as they're sometimes called, or the iGen, have lower rates of violence, lower rates of drinking, lower rates of the use of all drugs except perhaps marijuana, lower rates of sexually transmitted disease, lower rates of teen pregnancy. I think I mentioned car accidents. In just about every demographic variable you want to measure, they're actually doing pretty well. The happiness level of teenagers has barely budged in the last 20 years. There is some increase in depression, but there's an increase in depression in the United States since the Great Recession across the board, and it's not clear that it is really substantially worse for the teenagers today. More generally, across the world, rates of mental health, of depression, anxiety, have been pretty much flat for the last 30 years, contrary to fears that there's a worsening mental health crisis. Rates of suicide worldwide have declined by about 30% in the last 20 or 30 years. Again, we have a somewhat misleading picture from the United States, which is in some ways a kind of backward country compared to other Western affluent democracies. And in the United States, there has been a worsening since 1999. But what we tend to forget is 1999 was a pretty good year. That was when suicide kind of hit one of its low points. So there's been a general creeping up of suicides in the United States since 1999. That's not true of the world as a whole, and it's not even true of the United States over the course of the 20th century, when rates in the first half of the 20th century were far higher for the United States than they are today. And so it's a complex story. You have to break it down by generation, by age, because as people age, they naturally change in their rates of depression and anxiety and suicide. As population ages, suicide rates naturally increase, so you have to control for age structure. So there's no simple answer to the question, but the major generalizations are that, as I summarize them, is that levels of mental health are pretty much flat. Levels of happiness globally have increased. Levels of suicide have decreased.
First off, thank you so much for your book. It's such a light in the world. One thing that I was really struck by was the correlation of the growth of empathy with the printing press as people started to read, and then that translating into rights revolutions and others. What is your hope of like the next human skill and like what might be the next growth in humanity that leads to another, you know, exponential growth in the future?
Yes, it's the fact that increasingly we have a kind of a world culture. Now, of course, this has a downside in that there's kind of a flattening. Everywhere you go, well, not everywhere you go, but a lot of places you go, you can get you know, Thai food or Mexican food or Italian food, and young people wear blue jeans and fleece and sneakers and listen to a lot of the same music. Now, of course, that's something is lost by the lack of diversity, although it's kind of an increase in diversity in each location, a decrease in diversity comparing one place to another. But it does mean that there's fewer grounds to thinking that our country is really, really special and better than every other country, a less of a desire to or less of a temptation to see people in other countries as just so alien and foreign that you just can't get into their heads and imagine their lives. The interconnectivity, the greater amount of mobility, the greater amount of education and spread of knowledge in general, not always, not everywhere, but on average, it conduces to more liberal universalist values. This is something that's been shown by a project called the World Values Survey, which shows that worldwide there has been a general increase in liberal values, in acceptance of homosexuality, in encouraging children to be independent and creative, in rights of women, in religious freedom. And that it's obviously uneven across the surface of the world, but every region of the world has shown this trend, and it seems to be driven partly by affluence. Richer countries are, in general, more liberal, more concerned with the environment, have greater women's equality, but not just affluence, because there are outliers. In particular, the Gulf Arab oil-producing states are filthy rich but socially backward by many measures. Even more predictive is information flow. When countries are open, when they translate lots of books, when they have lots of patents, when they have lots of internet connections, when people have high levels of education, that seems to push them along the curve of greater tolerance, greater universal values. So I would name that as the main technological driver. I'll throw in one more, and that is that there's a big gradient along the cohorts. That is, as you go from the silent generation to the baby boomers to the Gen X to the millennials and probably to the iGen, although that has not yet been shown, the values for toleration, universalism, the opposite of racism and tribalism tend to increase as you get younger. And you might say, well, what difference does that make if people just get more bigoted as they get older? And the answer is they don't. That is the old saying that if your variance of if you're not a socialist when you're 20, you have no heart. If you are a socialist when you're 50, you have no head. It's been attributed to many wits and wags, but it turns out not to be true. People tend to carry their values with them as they age. There's a stronger effect of generation than there is of life cycle, which means that as the millennials push us baby boomers off the stage, there will be less homophobia, less racism. So that's another possible harbinger of change in that direction.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was cognitive psychologist and science writer Steven Pinker, whose new book is Enlightenment Now: The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espalet. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamantuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.